For more information on ancient dragon Zengate and Taigen's teachings, please visit our website at www.ancientdragon.org. Our teachings are offered to the community through the generosity of our supporters. To make a donation online, please click on the link for Just Give on our website.
Chicago Zendo. Good morning, ancient dragons. How many of you are dragons? Yes. I like that you identify that way. It's like my nephews would be so stoked. So, you know, there are lots of people know more about climate than me, including possibly people here. Definitely lots of people here know more about Buddhism than me. But all my work is about operating in places of overlap. Sometimes overlap of things that are not necessarily noticed to or reflected upon in their overlap. And I think that climate change comes as a kind of teacher, and that Buddhism makes a really useful framework for what it has to, for what we need to know, what we need to understand, how it needs to inform our actions. So the title, Under the Same Sky, was really enriched by my friend Jarvis J. Master. Some of you may know, renowned Tibetan Buddhist and innocent man on death row in San Quentin, California, who told me a few weeks ago, after the wonderful rains finally come to California, that he loved it when it rains. And he had three reasons. And the first one was that the more it rains, the fewer people want to go out into the exercise yard. And so if it's really pouring, he gets this rare, free, open, solitary space to himself. The last reason was that he knows when it's raining in prison, it's raining outside of prison, so it makes him feel connected to the rest of the world. I think that's sort of why we talk about the weather in a way. And there are some places, I've spent time in Ireland, where people are really good at talking about the weather, and they, you know, which is some verb conjugation of it has rained, it is raining, it is going to rain at all times. But it always feels like that's a little ritual where we reaffirm that we exist under in the same conditions, that we should have something in common, no matter what, you know, how strange we are to each other. So climate as a teacher and under the same sky. On the summer solstice of 2008, a lightning strike started a wildfire in the dry landscape around Tassajara Zen Center, a monastery in the rough mountains above Carmel, California. The Basin Complex Fire, as it was eventually known, became one of the largest fires in state history. It's difficult to say how and even whether climate change played a role, but we have seen an increase in intensity and frequency of wildfires in the state, as well as an expansion of fire season due to climate change. The Basin Complex fire burned 658 square kilometers of chaparral and forest over a period of weeks. After an extended period of monitoring the fire as it spread, a mandatory evacuation was given for the area of the monastery. At the last minute, a handful of people, including Abbot Steve Stuckey, stayed behind. San Francisco Zen Center monk David Zimmerman wrote afterwards, "The fire, like any dedicated teacher, challenged us to be continually attentive. For weeks, the Sangha, repeatedly informed that the fire was approximately 3 days away, had been preparing for an event that might or might not occur. Some of us even expressed impatience with the fire's initially slow progression, wanting it to come sooner so we could all just get on with things. But during the hours that the blaze was finally upon us, the tracking of time gave way to the pure immediacy of the moment. And I should say the fire came from three directions at once. The flames were like 20 or 30 feet high. It was not a campfire. It was walls of flame in pretty much all directions. And considered a situation so dangerous that the fire department, when they stayed behind, asked them for the names of their dentists so they could, if necessary, be identified from their dental records if they got burned to crisps. But during the hours that the blaze was finally upon us, the tracking of time gave way to the pure immediacy of the moment. What was most compelling during those hours, and which in reflection remains the most satisfying, is the constant vigilance and effort that the fire required. It was a sesshin through and through, a demanding schedule of pure presence in which one utterly let go of a known outcome. There are undeniable moments of fear and anxiety, especially when we understood the reality that the fire was descending into Tassajara fast and from all sides, rather than creep down one slope at a time, as it had initially been suggested by several professional firefighters. But there was little time to entertain fear, so fear quickly gave way to our effort to fully meet our belated guest and the tasks at hand. I should add to Dave's account that they saved Tassajara from burning down by keeping things wet and putting out the embers that were landing on roofs and buildings and things like that. They had this thing called the Dharma Rain that was their sort of improvised sprinkler system. So a decade ago, people talked about climate change as though it was in the future. We are now in that wild future. Things that were supposed to be centuries away are now decades away. Things that were supposed to be decades away are the reality we now live in. The New York Times reported last Thursday on the collapse of the West Antarctic ice sheet in these terms. For half a century, climate scientists have seen the West Antarctic ice sheet, a remnant of the last ice age, as a sort of Damocles hanging over human civilization. The great ice sheet, larger than Mexico, is thought to be potentially vulnerable to disintegration from a relatively small amount of global warming and capable of raising the sea level by 12 feet or more should it break up. But researchers long assumed the worst effects would take hundreds, if not thousands, of years to occur. Now new research shows the disaster scenario could play out much sooner. Continued high emissions of heat-trapping gases could launch a disintegration of the ice sheet within decades, according to a study published Wednesday. So we are in the midst of tremendous change, only a little less immediate and dramatic than the flames surrounding Tassajara. Buddhism has usually been used to think about sort of spiritual, psychological, ethical conditions, but we now need to think very urgently about physical, material, and natural conditions as well, and I think it's a useful tool for that as well. Climate change is the wildfire we're dancing with, the guest we need to get to know, the teacher come with urgent lessons, because here's the most important thing to know. We are in a closing window of time in which what we do now can affect the outcome for all time, in which we can escape the worst-case scenarios and move to the best. Doing so means keeping most fossil fuel in the ground and making a rapid transition to renewable energy. It is possible to do so, as it was not 15 years ago. The obstacles now are not technology. The technology has increased in sort of economic and affordability and efficiency and power in remarkable ways. The only obstacles are political will of the governments who are reluctant to upset the status quo and oppose the gargantuan powers who profit from this destruction. So our job is to be as powerful, which we can do together. Climate comes as a teacher that can be, I think, in useful dialogue with Buddha's teachings. The long era of human history, when the size of humanity as a whole was smaller, when we were one species among many, we didn't need to have the kind of responsibility because we didn't need to have the kind of impact. I think of this as a kind of long childhood, and the Industrial Revolution as a turbulent adolescence of growth and innovation and transformation, but also of adolescent destructiveness and recklessness. We now need to become, as a species, an adult with forbearance, foresight, generosity towards others, including others not yet born, and the sophistication about systems beyond immediate view. Climate itself teaches us much of what we need to know. Maybe the first teaching is change. Somebody once asked Suzuki Roshi, Shunryu Suzuki Roshi, the founder of San Francisco Zen Center, which I've been attending since 2001, kind of abashedly and shamefacedly, if he could sum up all of Zen in a sentence. And I think all the other students snickered, and Suzuki Roshi smiled and said, "Yes, everything changes." Did I get that right, Dan? That's good. So nothing has changed quite on quite the grand scale and as profoundly as the climate, which is the sort of precondition for everything else, the shape of continents, the weather, the crops, the inhabitable and uninhabitable areas, the species, and more. Climate will change the shapes of all our coastlines, the timelines of the seasons, the migration patterns of animals, the acidity of our oceans, the nature of our nature, has done it already, is doing it now. We're going to have to learn to adapt to a level of instability our species has not experienced since the last ice age ended 10,000 years ago. We're going to have to let go of some of the ideas of a patterned, repetitive, reliable Earth and come to terms with a more turbulent planet and a less predictable one. You could call this a lesson in impermanence and groundlessness. The arriving catastrophes will not affect all of us equally. The poor will bear the brunt, particularly the poor in island nations, mountain nations such as Nepal, the sub-Saharan Africa, and Central America, the tropics. Which is why climate change is a human rights issue. Part of the shock of attending the Paris Climate Conference last December was realizing that the argument was essentially between the desire of the poor to not be killed by the activity of the rich and of the rich to not give up their luxuries and profits. Since, of course, the wealthy had more power, what was often being said by those in a position to decide was more or less, "We're very sorry you're going to die, but we value profit more than life, than your life anyway." It was said in very nice, dignified, diplomatic, bureaucratic ways, but it was basically saying, "Fuck you, you're going to die, we're not going to give anything up, or we're not going to give enough up." And the sense of urgency from the delegation, the climate vulnerable nations led by the Philippines, was really extraordinary. People were fighting for their lives, and what they were fighting against was greed, was attachment, was grasping, was profit, was capitalism, was corporate selfishness, which then the short-sightedness, and that goes with them. And short-sightedness, the kind of shutdown that allows these, makes these things possible, because empathy, I think of, which literally means to feel with, is an expansion of the self into connecting with others so that you feel what you literally can't feel. When I step on a pin, I feel it. But when I have empathy, I feel it when you step on a pin as well. Lack of empathy, that killing off of empathy, that killing off of the expanded self is a precondition for being able to allow you to suffer, or to instigate your suffering, or to kill you myself. And so I feel like so much of what happens in the modern world is a kind of fight between the forces of ignorance and obliviousness that allows brutalities to happen. And the work of human rights activists, environmentalists, and in a different way, I think of Buddhist practice like this, which is to the practice of awareness. So much of what activists do is try and make visible what is invisible. We're now part of much larger systems than human beings ever were before. You know, we wear clothes made in Asia, we depend on fuel, mined in places we'll never see, burned in power plants we've never visited. We drink water from sources. Is this from the lake? Okay, well, you've probably all seen that. I live in California. Most people have never seen Hetch Hetchy, that feeds San Francisco, where everything we drink pretty much is snowmelt, and a lot of people, including San Franciscans, think California is a place where it never snows. But so the work often of environmentalists and others is to say, you need to become, you know, you need to see the Arctic, you need to see the sweatshops, you need to see the gulags, you need to see the species in our representations that you'll never see in person. And it's moving when people do care about those things, and they do. They can become passionate about polar bears. Have any of you ever seen a polar bear in the wild? Okay. Yeah, and yet, so making people care, it's a really interesting work. We often think of environmental work as intellectual, but it's also this kind of empathic thing of enhancing an awareness to expand to, you know. And I think that ethically we should all have a consciousness that and an awareness that expands as far as our impact does, which presents us all with a very difficult task of being aware of practically everything, since our impact, the emissions coming out of our tailpipes and our power plants, our engines, impacts everything now. To be aware of the acidification of the ocean, of the bleaching of the coral reefs, of the disappearance of species, of the fires in the rainforests, and. So climate change situates us in uncertainty. The data on what is happening and is likely to happen and what we can do about it technologically and politically keeps changing. The solutions do too. This is not a fixed body of knowledge, a dogma, a canon, a Talmud we can consult, but a wild scramble to keep up with what happens next, to be supple, flexible, open-minded. It's really an extraordinary historical moment. The scientists keep coming forth with more dire data. For example, that methane, far more methane is being produced than we thought, and it's a far bigger threat to climate. So we really need to think about carbon dioxide and methane. So, but what keeps pace with that is the technological innovations. I think of three groups of heroes for climate. One is the scientists bringing us this extraordinary news that allows us to see the real conditions, the real physical conditions of our Earth and the possibilities. Another is engineers who are actually giving us solutions that did not exist 15 years ago. One of the amazing things that happened to me recently is I read a history of coal by a woman who'd been a Midwestern administrator who got interested in the campaigns to shut down coal-fired power plants, but also the larger history. And it's a completely great book, and then the end is completely weird because it was published in 2004, and for me, reading it, it felt like it was written in another era because she doesn't think, at that point, solar and wind do not seem like adequate energy sources. She's talking about hydrogen, which is a kind of wild thing that hasn't come to fruition. And she's talking about carbon sequestration, which was kind of a pipe dream like kosher bacon, where we could still burn stuff and not have the carbon go into the atmosphere. And so everything has changed wildly around climate in the last decade. And the third thing that's changed is there was no meaningful climate movement a decade ago. There are little bits and pieces doing really good work, but it was small and feeble and fragmentary. The rise of 350.org, of climate movements in almost every country on Earth, the transformation of the Sierra Club into a much more progressive and engaged climate activist organization under new leadership, and the fact that almost every pipeline, coal-fired plant, fracking project, oil and gas lease, etc., is now being fought by activists in North America. The rise of Native peoples, the First Nations of Canada, Native Americans in this country, to the forefront of the struggle has also been a beautiful and extraordinary and transformative thing, particularly for people who we were told was our terrible past, who were part of our sad past and had disappeared or were ineffectual or were irrelevant, are now catalytic and powerful leaders in saving some kind of future for us all. So everything's changed, everything changes, and there's work to do. I think the Bodhisattva vow prepares us for this. Beings are numberless. I vow to save them. That's an endless and impossible task, and I love the cheerful directness with which we vow to take it on. I think that the political model we have in the West is, oh, this crisis is extraordinary. I will intervene and then go home and be apolitical and disengaged and tuned out again as I was before, which lays the groundwork for the next crisis to arrive. The Bodhisattva vow says there is no going home. The vow is home. You will never finish. And that's both good news and bad news, or news that doesn't require the binaries of good and bad. You will never be laid off from this job or run out of good work to do and good people to do it with. The second lesson is everything is connected. What we burn in our power plants, our cars, our homes is invisible. This invisible stuff accumulates in the ether of the sky. The ether of the sky insulates the earth. The thickening of this insulating blanket warms the earth. The consequences of this warming is not what we used to call global warming, which is too simple a description, but climate change or climate chaos. Since, as you know, for example, the polar vortex that made the winter before last so crazy came from actually weakening the sort of belt that holds the Arctic air in place. And so suddenly a bunch of Arctic air came down to the United States and froze the hell out of people in the Northeast. People love what chaos theory told us 20 years ago or so, that the flap of a butterfly's wing in Brazil influences the weather in China, that everything is connected can be beautiful when it's energy, life, joy, love moving down the line. But trouble is also systemic. What is burned in China influences the weather and the butterflies in Brazil. Non-separation is a basic tenet of Buddhism. This is how Taigen put it in Faces of Compassion. When we understand our deep connection to each other, the dichotomy between self and other, which is basic to our usual psychological ego operations, is exposed as a provisional fiction. Ultimately, we are each distinct expressions of one whole, not separate competing entities. It is impossible to be truly free and enlightened oneself if others down the street are in misery. To ignore the suffering of others is to ignore some part of oneself. That's talking about spiritual, moral, psychological reality. The central tenet of ecological and environmental thought for at least 150 years is that biological, physical reality is full of inseparable interconnectedness. That's been the default setting for how most people in most times and places viewed the world. Carolyn Merchant's landmark 1980 book, The Death of Nature, explores how what's considered the scientific worldview emerged along with capitalism as an alienated, authoritarian, and misogynist worldview in the 17th century in particular. Misogynist because nature was imagined as female and women were imagined as nature. Both were seen as chaotic, wild, monstrous things to be subjugated in the metaphors unloosed by these ideologies. Merchant writes, "The image of nature that became important in the early modern period was that of a disorderly and chaotic realm to be subdued and controlled." She quotes Francis Bacon describing the new notions of scientific method thus, "For you have but to follow and, as it were, hound nature in her wanderings, and you will be able, when you like, to lead and drive her afterward to the same place again. Neither ought a man to make scruple of entering and penetrating into these holes and corners when the inquisition of the truth is his whole object. It's the language of torture and rape as science." So, similarly, Johannes Kepler wrote to a friend in 1605, "My aim is to show that the celestial machine is to be likened not to a divine organism, but to a clockwork." This change matters because a divine organism, you have to treat with reverence, you recognize, has an internal coherence, runs itself, etc. A clockwork is made from outside. You can imagine tinkering with it. You can have the hubris to think you can improve upon it. And, you know, and you can misunderstand it, as we have all along, that when you start to interfere with one piece of it, other pieces go astray. You kill most of the beaver in North America to make beaver felt for hats in the 18th and 19th century. And you change the hydrology of a continent. You kill off wolves in Yellowstone on the theory that wolves are bad, and elk populations explode, and the ecology deteriorates, and many species, plant and animal, suffer that are neither wolves nor elks. You manufacture chemical products, you frack, you do all sorts of things, and you poison the water in the community that's supposed to profit from jobs in the industry. We do not engineer nature well. So, what replaced the picture of a living whole that was a worldview of the earth as a heap of dead fragments. And I don't think that we need to return to the mystical image of the earth as a mother, although science has offered, you know, although there's absolutely nothing wrong with it. And but I think, you know, in a sense, I'm not arguing that we go backwards to a pre-modern vision, but that we move forward to what science, as it's become more elegant and profound, has come to, which is a return to that vision of deep interconnection. And with the Gaia hypothesis James Lovelock put forward about a quarter century ago, the Earth as a living organism, as a whole, you impact when you impact any of its parts. So, and this is a direct, climate tells us everything is connected to everything else. It takes that version further and makes it more urgent than anything has before, just about. So this is a direct affront to conservative philosophy, which has gone further and further in recent decades in its assertion that things are not connected to other things. And this, I think, as I thought about it for this talk, is the very essence of conservative ideology in the United States as it currently exists. There are not systematic causes of poverty and oppression, so that an experience is not categorical, so that race or gender are not factors in our experience or how those experiences are limited. We are first and last separate individuals, and that individuality can be imagined as a form of isolation. So we do not depend on other humans. We do not owe a debt to other humans. And the collective systems known as society, we can, with Margaret Thatcher, say there is no such thing as society. We do not have obligations, human or non-human, that limit our actions or guide our interests, and anything that suggests such obligations exists is a form of oppression and loss of freedom. This libertarian ideology considers the freedom of the individual the ultimate value and opposes anything, notably environmental regulations, seen to limit that freedom. This was, of course, the ideology of anti-communism, and though that was specific opposition to specific countries whose communism morphed into totalitarianism, it also opposed the idea of the communal and the collective that is at the root of the word and idea of communism. It's a denial of relationship, of a portrait of a world of isolated objects and unsystematic realities. It's a political and social vision that corresponds well to the isolated fragments described by early modern science and scientific philosophy, as Carolyn Merchant lays out. This is why Republicans obsess over the ideas of being self-made men and overlook all the collective contributions to their success, security, and so forth, the advantages they may have been born with. And so this is why taxes are regarded as nothing more than a form of oppression. One owes nothing to the collective and receives nothing from it. It's why the idea of freeloaders, what Reagan's welfare queens, is so often emphasized, often paired with a wild distortion of where most of our taxes go, to emphasize their unfairness and unnecessariness. In the final fantastical end of this thinking, the nihilistic end, there are no facts. The denial that things are connected becomes a denial of cause and effect, eventually requiring a denial of science, history, and basic reasoning, and then meaning. And you see over and over the denial that pesticides are poisonous to other living organisms, just that there are larger consequences to our actions in the environment, or that what you do on your farm or your home or your factory takes place in a larger realm called the environment. In some sense, it's a denial that there is an environment rather than isolation. So this is why the whole idea of ecology is so offensive to them. It's the philosophy of how everything is connected materially, and climate change is its ultimate expression. the one we need to come to terms with. And as Naomi Klein pointed out in 2011, the solutions to these problems are in large part collective, cooperative, institutional, and international. And that's deeply problematic for people who prize the idea of the isolated individual and the isolated autonomous nation, who value non-cooperation as an ideal. Natalie Oreskes is a science historian who wrote Merchants of Doubt, says in that book, the reds dressed in green refrain, which was the term coined to claim that environmentalists were just socialism or communism in disguise. So the reds dressed in green refrain continues today. In December 2009, as world leaders tried yet again to craft an agreement to control greenhouse gases, 17 years after the UN Framework Convention on Climate Change committed them to do just that, Charles Krauthammer declaimed in the Washington Post that environmentalism was socialism by other means, a brazen attempt to transfer wealth from rich to poor. He wrote, "With socialism dead, the gigantic heist now proposed as a sacred is now proposed as a sacred service of the newest religion, environmentalism. The left was adrift until it struck on a brilliant gambit, metamorphosis from red to green." So, and then he denounced the EPA. So, as this kind of like terrifying invader of your sacred autonomy and privacy and et cetera. So that's what we're up against. And one of the things that is, not only did most of the mass media participate in the false dichotomy that there was a debate about climate in which a handful of scientists serving the oil corporations and the conservative interests in bed with them, did not represent scientific consensus on the reality and urgency of climate change. But that created a kind of confusion and delay, and that's why Oreskes' book is called Merchants of Doubt, that prevented us from doing much so far. And 100 years from now, when people look back and condemn most of us who did so little, the people who will be condemned the most will be this handful of people in the United States, the oil corporations, notably Exxon, which knew about climate change in the 70s and is now being investigated for its campaigns to hide the truth. So the conservative senators, et cetera, when you look at how the whole world wants a climate treaty, the whole world urgently wants these transformations, the U.S. is the biggest obstacle, and it's the biggest obstacle because of the Republican Senate in particular, which will not approve any treaties, which is why Obama has been negotiating non-binding treaties that don't with China, with the climate deal in Paris, to move around them. And so it's this very, very small, it's probably there's 300 people who, if they all retired tomorrow, the world, this is my nonviolent Buddhist practice, like, I would never wish harm to anyone on the Supreme Court. I have long wished that all the men would suddenly realize they needed to devote their entire life to golf. See, you can wish nonviolent blessings upon your antagonists. And so, if about 300 people immediately took up golf full-time and became apolitical, it would all be so much easier. But I think it's really important to look at how much the ideology of isolation, this conservative ideology, is essentially that things are not connected to other things, and that it's politically offensive to them to approach the solutions, but ideologically offensive to even accept the reality of the problem, which is climate is about how everything's connected to everything. So I think the third lesson is that we already have everything we need, that, there's... burning fossil fuel was really kind of like living off the saved energy, the sequestered carbon of millions of years. And it's shocking to me, even if, you can, and I think there's an argument that, yes, we should burn fossil fuel. We should burn it at slow a rate that it remains available for future generations for the next 10,000 years. But we've been racing through almost everything that exists in the fossil fuel world. Part of why you're seeing fracking and deep sea extraction and the pursuit of fossil fuel in Arctic, et cetera, is because a lot of the good stuff has already been burned. We've raced through a billion years of fuel in about 100 years with accelerating consumption. But we don't need it anymore. And the sense of becoming adults is that before fossil fuel began to be consumed, which is really something that begins on a small scale in England in the Middle Ages and then really begins with the 18th century and the Industrial Revolution, petroleum doesn't even become a meaningful part of our lives until the later 19th century. And here we have a whole world built upon it. So we can leave it behind. There was a wonderful banner. There were six banners for the six sections of the Climate March in 2014, one of which said, we have the solutions. Because, as I said, of the extraordinary transformations of affordability, capacity, efficiency, other breakthroughs around batteries and things, we could switch to renewable energy, you know, and there are no technological obstacles. There are only political obstacles, which is why it's a political fight at this point. We've overcome the other obstacles. So we can live off sun and wind. We can stop, you know, burning the carbon of a million and hundreds of millions of years ago and have this other kind of energy. So, and I'm not, you know, and it's complex. And I think it's important to acknowledge that we've benefited from it in some ways. But the benefits now can happen without it. I just spent a month in September, October with Roshi Joan Halifax in the Tibetan Buddhist part of Nepal, or what we call Tibetan, the Buddhist part of Nepal that China has not invaded and transformed. And it was, we gave out 400 solar lights. And it was really, people who have solar, like a lot of remote places in Africa, et cetera, they've leapfrogged, they've gone straight to solar without ever having gone through electrical networks. So, and seeing the kind of desire and gratitude for light was being reminded that, you know, I'm never kind of like, oh, we were fine when we didn't have technology. You know, I handed two solar lights to a nomadic woman who told me through the translator, I have lived my whole life in darkness. I met a woman who lived with one tiny fluorescent tube about this long to light the one room she lived in, which was about a third the size of this she lived in with her daughter and granddaughter. And I asked her what she had before the little fluorescent panel and the little fluorescent tube, and she brought out a butter lamp. That's what she was lighting her life with 7 years ago. But solar, you know, solar and these other technologies done well, you know, we are, you know, work for them, they can work for us. We already have everything we need. So, the fourth thing it teaches us, and that disasters in general teach us, is that disasters break things open, including our true selves. What am I doing on time? Okay. So I've spent a lot in a book called A Paradise Built in Hell, which was based on the extraordinary work disaster sociologists have done and on my own research into the firsthand accounts of a lot of major disasters, the 1906 earthquake, Eric Kleinenberg's great work on the 1990s Chicago heat wave, the Mexico City earthquake of 85, the Halifax explosion of 1917, the London Blitz, Hurricane Katrina, and 9/11. And what's interesting about disaster, the deeper I went into it, the more profound a philosophical subject it became. The assumption about how we behave in disaster is basically an assumption about human nature that the mass media, the powers that be, for the most part, and really crappy Hollywood disaster movies, including the most recent San Andreas one I saw in a motel recently, which is that human beings are basically selfish and greedy and cowardly, and in a crisis we revert to our true nature, which for the male half of the room is mostly raping and pillaging and looting, and for the female half is screaming and flailing our limbs uselessly and needing strong men to tell us what to do and help us do it or just carry us off bodily. And so we're basically sheep or wolves in that theory of human nature, and that's why a lot of authorities, notably in Hurricane Katrina, respond to disasters as social crises, that society has broken free of their control. Because what the authorities believe in more devoutly than anything else is their own necessity. And therefore, they think we're lost without them. And in fact, we're found without them. People are remarkable in disasters. The great majority of human beings are altruistic, brave, generous, resourceful, creative, and really, they take care of each other. Before the TV cameras get there, the neighbors rescue each other. The TV cameras arrive when the search and rescue professionals do, so we don't see that. But so the authorities think that they're reimposing, they're saving us from ourselves. And what they're often doing is treating us as the enemy and engaging in a reconquest and reimposing a status quo that doesn't work for a lot of people who may feel tremendously liberated from status quos, hierarchies, alienations and isolations in disaster. So not only are people good in disaster, which can feel kind of Pollyannish, we rise to the occasion, that's nice, but there's this fierce wild joy that I found over and over in accounts from the 1906 earthquake on through Hurricane Katrina and beyond, when people find agency, connection, meaningful work, a sense of fellowship. I think of it as a crash course in Buddhism, or a recovery of our true Buddha nature, you know, and that the facts of disaster, of how we behave in disaster, allow a completely different account of human nature that I think accords really well with the Buddhist idea that we all have Buddhist nature within, but we get distracted and confused. That joy for me says that we want things we don't have language for, that we don't ordinarily talk about. The language of our desires is always focused on private life, on material goods, sort of sex and personal, usually family life. But we want to be members of a meaningful society. We want to have purpose. We want to have hope. We want to have meaningful work to do. We want to have agency and a voice. We want to belong to something bigger than ourselves. And people sometimes find that in responding to the aftermath of a disaster. That doesn't mean that disasters aren't terrible, but it means that they're not only that everyday life is also a kind of disaster when it alienates and isolates us from our true nature and the possibility of connecting to the people around us and having a meaningful life. I think of it as a crash course in Buddhism because people stop worrying about past and future. There's a non-attachment. You know, you stop worrying. I remember I was really angry at somebody when the 1989 earthquake hit. And the minute the earthquake hit, I never thought about that person again. You know, and just like we spend most of our lives worrying about, like, did our mother love us enough? Is our pension fund going to be okay? And stuff like that. You stop worrying about that. And the kind of loss that's very difficult to deal with when it happens to you alone, William James pointed out, is very different. Like, if my house burns down and everybody else is fine, it can be very painful, partly because I'm so isolated. If the whole city burns down, we're all in it together, and people feel very differently about it. So there's an awareness of mortality that often makes people feel more alive. It's a really extraordinary thing. I wrote A Paradise Built in Hell because I came across all this extraordinary information and felt that in an era of climate change, when we're going to have disasters increased in frequency and intensity, which we're already seeing far, far more than, you know, we were 10 years ago, we need to know who we really are. And that it does seem like there's some possibility of making something out of this, of recognizing through disaster and maybe through Buddhist teachings that, you know, that this authentic self and this authentic civil society is the real wealth we have, not the wealth, and not the wealth that's advertised to us. It's the wealth that we need to value if we're going to move into a world where we're going to be less focused on the kind of advertised consumer goods and more on the kind of durable goods of community, hope, solidarity, connectedness, meaningfulness, sort of non-harmfulness, etc. So I think that, you know, that there are subtle ways in which telling a different story, because the way climate change has so often been framed is like, oh, we're going to have to give stuff up. It's as this terrible renunciation. And I think we can tell that story of renunciation a completely different way, as we're going to renounce mindless consumerism, we're going to have to renounce alienation and isolation, we're going to have to renounce disposability of human beings and cultures as well as of material objects. We're going to have to slow down and find that, you know, that I think that actually we have to renounce the deep poverty of kind of capitalist industrial age consumerism and reconcile us to instead the great wealth of more localized, more democratic, more engaged, more aware ways of being. And that's a revolution that makes our life so much better. And it's something Bill McKibben is actually very acute on in books like Deep Economy and Earth, that the changes we need will actually make our lives better, and so we don't have to be afraid of them. We have to be afraid of not making them. I have all these accounts of people in disaster, but since I'm in a Zendo, the only first-hand account of the half-dozen I have here I'll read is from Pat Enkyo O'Hara, was the head Eroshi of the village Zendo, a Zen Buddhist center when the trade towers collapsed. She remembered some years later, from that day, for a month, it seems like everybody was present to everybody. It was a transformation that was just striking. On the subway, eyes met eyes that never would have. There's a camaraderie that was incredible. It was palpable. It was wonderful. And there's a kind of open vulnerability that people felt. So, and then she talks about how that people closed down again. And it's interesting because there are cultures, I think Mexico City after 1985, where people were able to seize that moment and build permanent transformation for the better off it. Mexico City built a seamstresses union movement after the sweatshops, seamstresses worked in collapsed, and the owners treated the machinery as more valuable than the human beings trapped and crushed and dying and dead inside. Housing rights movement was created. A lot of political upheaval resulted. But often people have this beautiful experience, and because it's nameless, because it doesn't fit into their accounts of who they are personally and who we are together, they're unable to make something of it. And this is why, as a writer, I feel like stories are so essential to, you know, they're not decorative, they're not irrelevant, they're not trivial, they're a really important part of the work. I think it's also, Buddhism gives us a lot of stories of interconnectedness, of accepting change, of non-grasping, that are also really valuable. So, and then the last thing I think that climate teaches us is to be bodhisattvas, not arhats. So particularly in the early days of discussing climate change, people thought that personal virtue was going to be enough. And personal virtue is something Buddhists are really seduced by. So for climate, this meant framing the situation as, oh, I have compact fluorescent light bulbs, or I'm a vegan, or I drive a Prius, or I don't even own a car, but I bum rides from my friends and ride a bike, and thus I am not the problem. I am pure. I am standing aside from doing bad things. And let me ask you this. Like, okay, you put all compact fluorescent light bulbs in your house. Like, do we no longer have a climate problem? Nobody needs to answer that because it's too stupid a question. But that was often framed as though we just needed to have individual virtue. And that's kind of like saying, I'm watching somebody get beat up since I'm not actually beating himself. I'm not actually beating him myself with my own fists. I feel totally upright. You know, I'm doing absolutely nothing about this person, or I'm doing nothing about the lynch mob except saying like, hey, I'm not in the lynch mob. I'm awesome. Hey, they're hanging people. I'm not hanging people. I'm still awesome. You need more than that when somebody's being lynched, and people are being lynched and burned to death, starved to death, pushed off their homeland, pushed out of their culture, and non-human beings are. You actually need to do something. So you can't just say, oh, the house was on fire, but I didn't actually light it, and I evacuated myself alone, so I'm clean and unburned, and I'm a good person. You actually need to help people get out of the house. Particularly for us. I think that if you're a tribal person in Borneo, you're a campesino in Nicaragua, you're a sub-Saharan subsistence farmer or nomad in Africa, you're really off the hook. If anybody fits into that category in this room, you're off the hook. The rest of us, we are so on the hook. We are not just consumers, because when we frame it as like all you have to do is consume differently, that describes us as these really isolated, reduced beings called consumers. We are citizens. We are part of a kind of global sangha when you look at it ecologically. We have engagements and powers and obligations far beyond that. As citizens, we have an obligation to participate. An individual change will not save us. Only systemic change will. We need to scale up the marvelous things happening, the extraordinary movements out there now. we need to scale it up by doing that most each of us can do. So we need to not engage in the bystander behavior that thinks as long as we're not doing bad things, which is, as people often note, what allowed the Third Reich to arise, was not only that there were some really bad people out there, but that there were lots of good people who were thought that not being bad people was enough. We have to do more. And so more. Kwame Anthony Appiah said in the New York Times in November, "Moral narcissism is about being more concerned with the cleanliness of your hands than with how your conduct shapes the lives around you." I said, "Bodhisattvas, not arhats," because arhats is the old tradition of Buddhism where you're pursuing your own enlightenment, your own purity, your own spiritual advance, and that's kind of all you're doing. But you know, we're in the Mahayana tradition here. We're not Theravada, and we're on the big raft, which you can imagine as a life raft. We need to get all beings onto, not in terms of converting them, but of taking care of them. For me, the essence of Mahayana, big raft Buddhism, is that bodhisattva vow. Beings are numberless. I vow to save them. And as Taigen has written, checking out of the realms of suffering into personal enlightenment is seen as the fundamental violation of the spirit of bodhisattva ethics. The intention to save all beings is the primary moral imperative. So the bodhisattva vow is not beings are numberless, I vow to save me. And we often think about it in terms of sort of moral compassion, and that often becomes very hands-on with working with the homeless, with soup kitchens, etc., things I've done with San Francisco Zen Center. But there's also this engagement with the system of destruction that I think we're all impelled one way or another to engage with. Because the world will not be saved by individual acts of virtue. They do not add up to enough in this short amount of time we have to change everything. It will be saved by collective acts to change the fundamental conditions of how we live on Earth. Only collective acts will bring about the systemic changes we need in order to ensure a future, the immense variety of life on Earth, the numberless beings will survive in. Or as Bill McKibben wearily said as we sat on the floor at an activist center in Paris during the climate summit, when a young woman asked him what was the best thing an individual could do about the climate, he just looked at her and said, "Stop being an individual." Thank you.
Thank you very much, Rebecca. So we have some time for discussion. I'll just add that I know that in the next month there are various climate actions through the Future Network and others happening in the Chicago area. So we'll be announcing those here and bringing them on the next month, just to say that. And so if people have comments, questions, responses for Rebecca,
I think some of you who are really serious, much better students of Buddhism than you, may have other frameworks that would be really interesting. There's often a notion of question and answer as like, I know things and you don't, or people who think I'm wrong are going to tackle me about it. But I think that what I'm doing is putting forth propositions, and there may be other propositions as well that augment or shift or sharpen what we're all trying to address. And those I'd be really interested in hearing those as well. Just to sort of get, yeah.
One comment was the mission that you put out with John Halifax, which is a good friend of mine.
Yeah.
I spent a great deal of time at the Mind Zen Center, so anybody can consider doing sort of a physical health issues that prevent people going this year. Every year that mission goes, I say, when you go, but if anybody's interested in going, it's on the PIDA.org website.
It was amazing. I think it's full this year already, but next year is, and there, it's a particularly, like we did 140 miles going up to an elevation of almost 18,000, was it 18,000 feet or 9, was it 8? And it was incredibly grueling. They're going back to the same place and doing 200 miles. Yeah, and she's on horseback, which from outside always, most of the time, which sounds really easy, but I got on a horse some of the time, and you're basically like, she says, I tell myself the horse wants to live, because a horse is walking along the precipice, you know, as much as drinking out of a skull cup or meditating on your mortality. Sitting on a horse on those trails is engagement with mortality. So thanks for bringing it up.
You just mentioned there's a wonderful article that Rebecca wrote about that in the New Yorker.
Yeah, and what was also remarkable about that trip was I witnessed firsthand people who had never... Basically, it's a road... We went to Dolpo, which is one of the remote places, the Tibetan Buddhist place I mentioned earlier. It's almost... The expanse we're in is basically roadless. Internal combustion has never been part of people's lives there directly. There are no roads. There's almost no machinery. In a lot of ways, people are living the way that they were hundreds of years ago. They're plowing with wooden yaks and wooden plows. They're harvesting and reaping and threshing and grinding by hand, etc. But it's also a place tremendously impacted by climate change. They had a really poor harvest. The seasons are changing. The glaciers are melting. It's a very arid part of the world. It's the Tibetan Plateau is kind of a cold desert. But higher up, there are these tremendous glaciers and snowpacks that feed it. So you see these miracles of fresh, cold streams of water flowing through dry, stony valleys coming from the heights that you don't see often until you get to the high places. You know, at 17,000 feet, you can see the 25,000-foot peaks. So, and as that melts, they'll lose their reliable year-round water, and it may become this area with the 1,000 years of Buddhism, of some of the really important temples for the tradition, with this sort of unbroken lineage of culture, is one of the regions that climate change will probably make uninhabitable. So we're doing that. And that's what I mean with sort of understanding the connection, that what we do here has everything to do with whether these people who've hardly burned any fossil fuel in their lives, you know, are burned out of their homeland. But.
For everybody, requests that are over 10,000 minutes in a month.
Yeah.
Take 10 to write to your congressman.
Yeah.
That's not enough.
Having lived in Japan a long time, it's real interesting how they function as a society, and it's very, very, in some ways, very repressive because everybody's mm-hmm. worried about what everybody else thinks, but it's very, very much cooperative.
Yeah.
And one of the worst things that could have happened to you with the Japanese in pre-modern Japan was to be thrown out of the village. That was a death sentence, really.
Yeah.
When a disaster came, the village bonded together and they helped each other and they all survived. And if you're thrown out of the village, you're basically not part of that. So it's very interesting how I have friends who were in Japan during Fukushima. All these people, dentists and doctors, went up to the Fukushima area and were donating their time and money and help to people, bringing toothbrushes. My friend was a dentist up there, and he bring toothbrushes and toothpaste because they didn't have any, and they lost them.
Yeah,
money.
Yeah.
It's just that sense of collectiveness and being and helping each other, I think, is real important. Somehow we have to embrace it here among ourselves.
Yes, thank you.
Okay, so just in addition to the sort of overarching denial that you talked about in our political sphere, mm-hmm. there's sort of these sub-denials, too.
Oh, right? What a great term.
And a big one for me is animal agriculture. So depending on whose estimates you look at, something like 30 to 50% of our greenhouse gas emissions are directly a result of animal agriculture. So here we have a solution staring us in the face.
Yeah.
And nobody will even talk about it. So we can eliminate overnight, you know, a huge fraction of our greenhouse gas emissions if we just stop the practice of animal agriculture. And so, you know, this fits in very well with Buddhism and compassion toward all beings. You know, we are slaughtering billions of animals and polluting the atmosphere at the same time. And these are connected. So the connections between these issues are, you know, people treat these as different issues and they ignore the climate change aspects of it. But I really believe that could make huge progress just by dealing with this one issue.
You know, I agree. It's, you know, and it's the math on it is complex. It's mostly, it's methane, and we're now realizing that fracking is producing insane amounts of methane that really kind of dwarf this other stuff. But it's methane from, well, cow farts, but also from other kinds of, you know, and there's also just huge amounts of fossil fuel used to raise the grain we feed to livestock in the U.S., that eating lower on the food chain. And it's interesting because you can tweak those things. There are people studying how you can make cows part of a rotational grazing system that's actually engaging in carbon sequestration, which is not how most people are going to get their hamburgers. So, like, you can change how animal agriculture works to some extent and make it less destructive, but I also, I totally agree, eating a lot less animal products and lower on the food chain, et cetera, as, you know, and I also think it's really useful to tell people, my brother worked in sort of mental health for a long time, and he talks about the harm reduction model. You don't have to become a vegan overnight. That harm reduction is that you're just doing a lot less, you know, and some things more red meat more than birds and fishes, and you all know the drill. So, yeah.
I would just like to sort of perversely put in a plug for the sort of kernel of truth in the observation that Charles Krauthammer made and that you mentioned today. In some ways, I mean, it's in sort of, you know, a classically Marxist kind of way. It's presented upside down, but it sort of identifies the same truth that the Occupy people identify, which is that, in fact, and I think it ties into your point about getting over this sort of sense of isolatedness and separation, because there's been this tremendous tendency for, you know, people to regard, we, as you say, you know, we confront these sort of massive systemic things as sort of individuals, as sort of me against this horrible situation. Part of what the Occupy people did in sort of economic terms to start to articulate that, in fact, there are these, you know, for all kinds of different people, all kinds of different constituencies, there are these commonalities, and that one very sort of crude index to identify what those commonalities are and start building on them is to see that, in fact, not that there's, we have to demonize anybody or whatever, but Charles Krauthammer's thing is, you know, that he's got backwards, but it's just fact there's this kind of radical, you know, expropriation that's been going on for, you know, 300 or 400 years. But, you know, maybe broadening it out from the Occupy view, it's not just economic, it's cultural, it's between species and so on, and that it really helps to, as I say, not to demonize anybody particularly, but to identify, in fact, that there's this common and very sort of multifaceted exploitation, maybe the word doesn't seem right, but and it's not just, you know, something that, you know, I'm experiencing, you're experiencing, but that we're experiencing together, and that we're in fact experiencing with the wolves, and that we're in fact experiencing with animals and feedlots and so on and so forth.
Yeah. Well, the funny thing about the Krauthammer is that he's actually right, that in some sense that, like, red disguised as green, and that there is a lot of overlap. You know, and it's not exactly like, I don't think a lot, you know, the Sierra Club has never been a Marxist organization, and it actually has its own, much more conservative origins. But the analysis of the necessity of understanding collective and systemic good and acting in reference to it, you know, does connect them in some ways. You know, and so, yeah. Yeah,
no. Many are very committed to social justice and climate change and compassion for other people.
Yeah, no. I didn't mean to diss, you know, people in that tradition, and I know that who have, you know, Thich Nhat Hanh, for example, the Burmese monks in 2007, extraordinary histories of engagement and connectedness. But just that Mahayana really, as I understand it, really shifted the focus to the Bodhisattva rather than Arhat ultimate goals. And, you know, so, and I just find it a useful model for, and I think a lot of people in the West think, like if you tell some, like there's so many people who don't know much about Buddhism who think, first of all, probably thanks part two, Phil Caplio's Three Pillars of Zen, that we're all pursuing enlightenment like dogs chasing rabbits. And, you know, that it is this kind of very goal-oriented pursuit. And that, you know, on the Bodhisattva side of it, I think is not that well known. So, I mean, I think that, but I do think a lot of Westerners, you know, we come out of a tradition of isolation, and it's very easy to let Buddhism become this kind of purification, improvement of the self, and even no matter how often you chant the Bodhisattva vow. So it's not like those people aren't doing it and we're doing it perfectly, but it's just like this shift gives us this really big role of this template that seems to be, you know, the Bodhisattva idea and vow seem to apply very well to climate here and to the way that people, I think, you know, in the West have tended to think that they're sort of excusing themselves by saying I'm no longer part of the problem is adequate, and I wanted to argue for its inadequacy, that no, you know, to go back to the 60s, if you're not part of the solution, you're part of the problem. But, yeah. McKibben has these beautiful, very Vermonty, but very utopian visions in some of his recent books of what the alternative looks like, what a kind of local, democratically accountable economy looks like that's not, you know, kind of endlessly driven to consume and grow and etc. So yeah, I totally agree. I also think we're in a really interesting moment kind of ideologically. And when the Soviet Union collapsed, there was all this triumphalism about how communism failed, capitalism is totally awesome. And there wasn't that much criticism of it through, you know, until Occupy, that 2008 crash, and then Occupy Wall Street, and the fact now that, like, people registered as Democrat are not frightened by the word socialism, the success of Bernie Sanders. It feels like people, in a lot of different ways, in this country, which has been one of the great progenitors of capitalism and growth, are really ready to turn away from it. And then it feels like it's, or more, far more people, you know, don't believe in capitalism and are enthused about alternative visions. And that's kind of exciting, you know, because it really opens up possibilities. And of course, as you say, it requires articulating, well, then what's, if we don't do it this way, how do we do it? But, you know, may the experiments flourish. So, yeah. Oh, okay, yeah.
Thank you, first of all. Just, I'm so appreciative that you came.
Thank you. Yeah.
Self-regulating organism or being, and he has the intention that our biosphere can sort of comfortably support about 3 billion humans.
Yeah. You know, I think that his articulation of, you know, his vision of the earth as a sort of living, you know, organism in which all the parts are integral to the whole is the part that I wanted to take from him. Some of his more recent stuff, not so much. And, of course, how many people the earth can support depends on how they're living. And I've heard it said that it could support 20 billion Indian peasants. You know, it can't support 3 billion, you know, North Americans. So that, you know, and that matters, that, like, you know, as he referred to, like, how, you know, that humans are, in terms of sort of carbon footprints, consumption footprints, we're not all the same size by a long shot. So, but it's also interesting to think that, you know, we do act on those visions. Rachel Carson articulates that Didi, you know, and that's one of the great revolutions. So you really look at the world in which all these chemicals were introduced, the sort of asbestos and PCBs and DDT and the rest, the kind of better living through chemistry, mid-20th century. And it's really based on the denial that these things stick around and do, you know, they do what they're intended. DDT kills the insects on the crops, but then it just keeps killing. And, you know, and the way we often react is the collective thing known as kind of legislation, regulation, etc. We banned DDT in the United States. You know that we've had some regulation related to sweatshop. You know, on different scales, college kids had this great movement about 15 years ago, where they're recognizing that, you know, school products being sold on campus were sweatshop made, and sort of the sweatshop free movement, the divestment movement, acknowledges that we're connected by where our assets are invested. And there's this lovely announcement at the climate conference of like $3 trillion, I think, is that right? 2.7 or $3 trillion have been divested to date. So it's interesting that it begins first by just articulating a connection and the moral grounds for response and stuff. And, you know, and a lot of it, and it's one of those things, there's a tendency on the part of the left, my beloved unbearable brethren, to always frame it as like, nothing has been done. We're starting from zero. And I think often that a position that's actually much more accurate is that good things are being done. We already, like, amazing people are out there doing good things. We need to scale them up. And so, like, you can look at all these movements to pull back from sweatshops or child labor or different kinds of toxicities, dumping effluents in rivers, etc., and see. And, you know, often popular movements are what changes them. And then that I think, is kind of the collective response to the news of interconnectedness, often the one that works.